Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotional worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth. What's on your mind today?
Thank you, Donna. Well, today what's on my mind is that it's Mental Health Awareness Month. And as part of that, I thought it would be a good time to revisit why it is that I actually sit in this chair every Tuesday and do this show. Why is it that I am the reluctant therapist? And I get asked that quite often. It's like, why do you do this show? What are you so reluctant about? So that's kind of the place where my mind is. And I also want to talk about kind of some hope that I have for the mental health field, and also some ongoing concerns, because I wouldn't be me without that. But there are some hopeful things on the horizon, and actually some hopeful things that are being done today that are really effective. So I want to talk about that. And then I also wanted to talk about one of the greatest challenges to mental health care is that when people are in need of getting help, they're usually in a time of crisis. And when we're in a time of crisis, we don't make the best decisions, or we're feeling panicky or overwhelmed. And so we're kind of grasping at straws to figure out who it is we should go see. And then there's the challenge, of course, with our health insurance and being limited of who we can see and who will take insurance, and then being limited by finding someone who actually has space in their practice to see someone. And so I thought it might be helpful also to talk today about the wide spectrum of different types of mental health care professionals, and also different kinds of treatments, and how to figure out what it is that we might be best served by. Because one of the things that's always been, I don't know if challenging is a word, but frustrating for me, is that when people start thinking about, and not all people, but oftentimes when people think about, oh, we're having a mental health crisis, or my child's in trouble, I need to go see someone, I want to get the best for my family, and so of course the best is going to be a psychiatrist because they're an MD. And that first train of thought oftentimes get people into a lot of trouble, because if you look at the overarching work of the psychiatry profession, it's about writing prescriptions for medications. There are psychiatrists who do functional psychiatry and do talk therapy. I know that they're doing good work and changing up their practices and the way they approach people. But for someone who is tied to their insurance plans, they don't have as many options in choosing that psychiatrist. And more often than not, they're going to end up with someone writing prescriptions. And that's concerning, because for the vast majority of people who are looking for mental health care for themselves or their family or their children, they don't need that level of attention. The vast majority of people who are seeking mental health care need someone to hear their story and help them through a transition or a rough patch or grief or relational issues or parent-child struggles. And none of those are diagnosable conditions. None of those are mental illnesses. All of them are common occurrences throughout the lifespan, and they can be challenging, and we can benefit from the help of someone who has experience and knowledge. And that would require more counseling than really psychotherapy. So I want to talk about that as well today. So it's multifaceted, the directions that we're going and what we're going to be covering. And also, I'll be opening up the phone lines, because I'm always curious to know what people's experience with mental health care is. Because a lot of people feel that their life has been changed and saved by the use of medications or finding that great therapist or doing a specific kind of modality or intervention. And I always like to hear those stories, because that helps us to build confidence in the profession. And at the same time, it's important to understand that there are a lot of challenges to the profession and to talk about them, but people still need help. And that's the conundrum for the reluctant therapist, is that people need help. The challenge is, how do we find the right kind of help and make sure that people aren't falling into situations that at the end of the day become harmful? That's the challenge. And then I'm thinking about this show. And last night, as I was putting together my notes, I was thinking, you know, really need to focus on the hopeful piece, to, you know, really talk about the ways that people can get better or feel better or move forward or get the care that they need. And there's been so much work and effort put into destigmatizing mental health care and to, you know, make it available to a lot of people. And so I'm, you know, self-talking to my way through this last night. And then, of course, I come across an article in the New York Times, which then completely speaks to the reluctant therapist in me. And it's a whole article about, are we talking too much about mental health? And then it goes into this concern that over recent years, there's been such work to destigmatize mental health. And there's so much information out on TikTok and Instagram and different social media platforms. And that many school districts have gone all in to provide these giant mindfulness and problem management and coping programs within the schools to help children, and having group talk, you know, for kids to be able to talk about their feelings and help children or kids to understand the feelings that they're having. There's been so much effort put into that without even taking a breath to think, is this a good plan? Or should we consider, you know, what some of the unintended consequences have been? But again, when it comes to mental health and the fear of kids suffering or struggling and, you know, wanting to make sure that children are cared for, it's been an all-in push to make sure that all of this information is out there, and it has to be a good thing. But of course, now research is starting to come up that shows that for a lot of children, these big programs on campus in schools is having an opposite effect, that kids that might have been struggling or weren't really struggling are now starting to have rumination issues and starting to feel like they're more anxious, or feeling like their sadness or their nervousness is an indication that they have a mental illness. And so they're conflating the experience of being a normal kid growing up or an adolescent going through the changes in their life as a part of a mental illness. It's much like doctors when they go to med school, or even therapists when they go to graduate school, and we read the DSM and we start looking at the diagnosis or all the ways that we could be ill or have a disease, and then you have them all. And so it's much like that, you know, it's great to help young people understand feelings and emotions and to be able to talk about them. But when it becomes cloaked in this idea that we have a crisis and an emergency and mental health is on the line and everyone's at risk and at danger, then all of a sudden the kids look around and think, it must be me too. I must be having these issues. I feel that way. I sometimes feel really sad. I sometimes feel really anxious. Oh my goodness. So in some ways, we're creating more mental health issues than we had before these big programs were started. And so what do we do with that? Because it's clear that there are mental health issues and the kids are struggling and need support. And without giving too much away for the whole hour, I'll tell you this. The DARE program was a great idea in theory and ended up to be an entire flop. The whole anti-bullying campaigns were a good idea in theory, but research has shown these big giant programs really haven't brought about the change that was anticipated. And my concern is it's going to be the same with these giant mental health care initiatives flooding the schools. It's going to create more issues than it's actually going to solve. And the concern about these giant programs, especially ones around mental health, is that when you throw this idea about our mental health and feelings and are you anxious and are you depressed and do you have, you know, some sort of disorder, and let's remember that there's a huge wave of young people and adults, but young people self-diagnosing because they've seen something on TikTok or there's been a professional, and so they're going to their parents or they're going to their counselor and saying, I have depression or I have bipolar disorder. And so they're bringing about information that they really don't understand how to use or they really fit that. And so by creating this idea that when someone is struggling emotionally with feeling depressed or anxious or alienated or isolated or whatever that mental health issue is, that it's the individual that's sick. And that's the biggest danger of all of this. When we have programs or information that targets the individual as being the source of their illness, we do two things. We lead them to believe that it's biological, which it's not, but we lead them to believe these feelings are just biological diseases that they can't do anything about, and that can cause deep depression. But the other thing we do, which is the greater crime in all of this, is that it allows us to take a pass in solving the greater social issues that drives much of the anxiety and depression and fear and isolation that young people experience, especially our adolescents who are coming awake, right? They're waking up to the realities of the world around them. And it's a big, scary place. And there are a lot of problems. And it would be normal to feel anxious and depressed and fearful and confused when you look at the level of climate change and wars that are happening and economic issues. It would be normal to respond with those emotions. In many ways, it would be actually abnormal to have an awareness of the complexities of the problems in the world and to not feel some of those things. I would be much more concerned about someone, a young person who said, nah, life's great, I have no problems, everything in the world is wonderful. I'd be more concerned for that student or that young person. And so there, for me, lies the biggest problem with our work in the helping professions, is that somehow we've turned back the clocks to almost Freud's era, where in his original psychoanalysis, the idea was that the individual was the source of their disease or their unrest or their disorders, and fixing that individual was the key. It took 40, 50 years from Freud to finally get to the talk therapy understanding of Carl Rogers and a lot of the existentialists, where we started to understand, oh no, we are social beings, and our mental health and our well-being and our personalities and our temperament are often tied to the experiences we have in the world around us. It took us that long to get there. And in the course of the last 5 years, we're starting to flip that back and focus mental health issues on the individual again. And here's the problem. We've been dealing with mental health issues for 200 years, if you look at psychiatry and early psychology, and the talk therapy piece for almost 100 years. And we haven't come up with a fix or a solve that completely heals people. We don't have it. And so when we focus on the individual, we set up someone for a life of feeling other than or diseased or ill. And I wonder how much more powerful it would be if we focused on the social issues that cause us to feel anxious or depressed. If we had actions that we could take, that young people could take, so they felt like they were part of the solution and not an individually diseased or sick or ill person. How differently would that experience through school be? Instead of having these giant programs of, you know, trying to address mental health, why do we have giant programs of growing food on campus or having campaigns to deal with climate change or have conversations about the economy or how they can take action to secure their future? And then you have them working together on something that makes them feel like they're part of something greater than themselves and outside of their minds, because it's that rumination and living in our minds and wondering about every feeling and blip and discomfort that we have that can get us stuck. And that stuckness is where mental illness lives, that sense of I can't move away from the way my brain responds to the world around me. I didn't think I'd jump that fast, so quickly, that far so quickly, but here's where we are today. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you are invited to be part of this conversation. It's 805-781-3875 is our number, but you can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com after the show, or you can follow us on Instagram or Facebook and leave me a message there. I'm happy to respond. And you can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org or podcast the show wherever it is you find your podcasts. Hit subscribe and the show will be there for you to listen to at your convenience. So I'm glad you're here today. We're going to talk about a bunch of things revolving around mental health. And we'll take a quick break and come back and start the conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Take all of your wasted honor, every little past frustration. Take all of your so-called problems, better put them in quotations. Say what you need to say, say what you need to say. Say what you need to say, say what you need to say. Say what you need to say, say what you need to say. Say what you need to say, say what you need to say. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. So, how did I get here in this chair as a reluctant therapist? Well, I'm not really sure where it all actually started because I don't keep a journal or diary of those things. But by looking back over the archives, somewhere in 2007, I had an idea for a show to talk about mental health care and my concerns about the direction that the mental health care and the helping professions were going. And so I brought it up as an idea here at KCBX. And so I was given this 15-minute slot once a month to do this little version of a TED Talk every month. And oh my goodness, that took so much time to come up with a topic, but then to have this whole story written in 15 minutes and to edit it and to record it. And it took a long, long time to do each of those shows. And that went on for a couple years. And the original idea was sparked because I had worked for the county at that time. And before that, I was working for the county. So when I went to graduate school in the 1990s at Pacifica Graduate Institute, it's a very kind of holistic Jungian depth psychology program. And that expanded kind of my worldview and understanding understanding of how people behave and how the psyche works. And my internship when I came out of Pacifica was with a county program here in San Luis Obispo. And part of that, the bulk of my job was working with at-risk families. And so we would go into their houses. We were all MFT, either interns or licensed MFTs at that time. And we would work with families that weren't part of the social system yet. They were kind of on the verge, but the hope was we could help them get stabilized and they wouldn't fall into social services. And so I did that for a number of years. And it always was concerning to me that the families that we would see were pretty much universally treated like they didn't know what they were doing. And they were kind of subject to whatever their case plan would lead them to have to do. And after I left that program, I started working for another program, which was an at-risk preschool. And so at this place, I worked with the children, but I also got to work with the families. And it was a really unique situation because I could see the kids at school and how are they behaving. But then I also got a great insight of what was going on at home and could see the connection between what was going on at home for a lot of these children and how that behavior would come up at school. And so it kind of affirmed my belief in the whole systemic idea of mental health and behaviors and well-being, that we are products of the world in which we live and we respond psychically and emotionally and physically, mentally, to those experiences that we have. And kids were the great litmus test or the great canaries in the coal mine. You knew exactly how the parents' relationship was going, if there was some sort of upheaval at home, or if they weren't getting enough sleep or weren't getting breakfast in the morning. You could see those behaviors at school. Well, the concerning part was that, I don't remember if it was weekly or monthly now, it's been so long, that we would go to meetings for the county and talk about the cases and the kids. And there was a psychiatrist that led these meetings. And almost every single case, every single time, prescriptions were written for every single child. And I couldn't understand how, without meeting the children or knowing the family or just reading what the social workers have written, that we were writing prescriptions, large amount of prescriptions for children as young as 3 years old for psychiatric conditions that how could we know a three-year-old had. And I could spend the whole hour talking about it, but I won't. But it was one of the tipping points for me, looking at my profession, thinking this is not helpful. It's actually really frightening how we are looking at mental health in children. Around that same time, I had a very close friend, very, very close friend, who had gone through a breakup and was having a lot of struggles and needed help. And I said, you should go talk to someone. I think it'd be really helpful. I think you've got some level of, you know, depression going through this issue, and I think it'd be super helpful. Well, that experience led to medications, not just one, but multiple, and then more medications and different therapists, and then elevating to psychiatrists, and then different programs. Long story short, I lost this friend to the whole world of mental health care from each clinician that was really well-intended and thought they knew my friend and were doing the best they could, but it ended up with him going into a deep, deep psychosis for years because of the overuse of medication and the underuse of well-done psychotherapy. So that tipped me as well. And so that's why I approached the station and said, I want to do this show because I think we need to talk about the ways that our mental health care system really isn't serving the collective and that people need to be aware of what's out there and to be able to make decisions for themselves. And so they said, sure, let's do this. So I did it for a while, a couple of years. I can't remember how long now. In 2008, May 7th, 2008, so almost this day, I did a show called on the overuse of medications in treating children diagnosed with attention deficit disorders and the barriers they had to utilizing other alternative treatments. And at the time, my hope was we would talk about this in 2008, and then by 2009, there would be so much cultural awareness that we would change. And here we are in 2024, and haven't really moved the needle very much at all. If anything, we've doubled down in many ways, and we've diagnosed more people with ADHD and more people on meds, and that's discouraging. But I've pressed on, and I think it was sometime around 2011, I'm not really sure, we took the format from the 15 minutes and it became this 1 hour show. And the idea was to have a call-in show so that people could access a therapist, because it was really important to me that I gave away a lot of what I knew for free, because it was very expensive to access clinicians. And I wanted people to have knowledge so that when they were going to therapy, they would know what to ask the clinician or maybe what clinicians to go see. So that was the original intention of the show. It was like, I'll open the microphone a la Fraser Crane and people can call and ask questions, and that's what we'll do. And on the very first day that I came in to the station to do this, my program director, as I walked by her office, said, is this going to work? And I looked at him and, oh my gosh, I thought you thought it was going to work. I don't know. And just smiled. And I walked into the studio and opened up the phone lines. And here we are today. So in many ways, it's worked. I think we counted at some point, it was almost 700 shows that we've done about mental health and mental health care and all sorts of other topics along the way, alternatives to how we can support our mental health and well-being. I wish things were much different. They're not, but I do see more professionals who've aligned with this idea that we need to change the way we're looking at mental health and mental health care. We have to acknowledge that our thought that we might be able to medicate people back to some sort of level of functioning was not really going to work, that we were managing symptoms, but we weren't really bringing people to a higher course of functioning overall, and that we weren't looking at the wide spectrum of mental health. And that was the biggest issue, is that we started treating everyone with every issue with the same hammer, when really for most people, they need the gentle caress of a soft hand and not really a hammer to get through. And so that's been wonderful. And also the emergence of different modalities like ACT, which is acceptance commitment therapy. And there is DBT, dialectical behavior therapy. And of course, CBT. And then the new, one of the newer thoughts or newer schools of thought is EPP, which is existential positive psychology. And all of those, what they have in common was this understanding that we, in order to help people, people had to be willing to help themselves and change, that the therapist could offer information and tools and insights. But at the end of the day, it's the clients that had to be willing to live with a level of suffering and discomfort and find the ways they can thrive in spite of the discomfort and struggling that they experience. And that has become the real turning point. Because prior to this, there was a period of time where the pain scale was brought into the medical field, kind of around the time that opioids took off, that this pain scale became a part of the medical field. And people were asked, what level of pain are you in? Give me that number. And then wherever the person's number is, they would be given medications to alleviate or eliminate the pain. Prior to that, if you had surgery, you were told it's going to be really painful after surgery. You're going to have a recovery time that's painful and you're just going to have to deal with it. But this pain scale idea was that no pain was acceptable and it was going to be eliminated. And that's how we got into the whole opioid, fentanyl, pain relief trouble. Well, that same idea was brought over to psychotherapy. And the idea was no suffering is tolerable. So we're going to give people medication so they feel no suffering at all. Also, they were feeling no sex drive, you know, no enthusiasm for anything, but no pain. That was the goal. And so it's taken until these last 10 years, really 5 years, if I were to be honest, 5 years, that finally the mental health profession is saying, no, the truth is there is some level of suffering in being a human being, and to understand that and be realistic about it and then also find ways to live a life where you're thriving, that's the goal of good mental health care. And that's really where I want to focus part of the show today, is some of those ways that we can access the kind of mental health care that's realistic, not Pollyannish, but realistic, that could bring about change in our lives. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and our number is 805-781-3875. Tom, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Okay, I just wanted to say hello.
Hello.
Elizabeth, great to hear you. I've worked in the mental health field for over 20 years at Atascadero State Hospital, which is a little bit different of a ball game than you're doing. I just listening to you, I can tell you are more in the early stages of kids at risk and what leads them into life of crime eventually, or it can happen. So what I saw working at my end was the end result of single parent families, poverty, crime from all over the state. And they're brought in from to Atascadero State Hospital, which is a men's facility, as you know, for felons. Mm-hmm. They're all felons. With mental health issues. And so my job was, I worked in the admissions area, and they would bring them in from prison, from jail, from with not only 5150s, but 1370s, which is they've actually been charged with a crime. Their mental health has led to a crime.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, if I'm rambling, let me know. I just wanted to let you know that I really like what you're saying. I totally agree with what you're saying about overprescription and this bombardment of our kids these days, that you probably have a mental illness of some sort, which they may not. It's just times are tough. There's a stressful environment with especially with the social media world. It's really had a really bad effect, I think, on the kids.
I agree. And
that's my opinion.
No, Tom, I appreciate it. And I'm glad you called, because one of the things I wanted to address today was this vast spectrum of mental health, that on one end we have the severe chronic psychosis, schizophrenia, true bipolar disorder, true major depression, real serious mental health issues. And that is usually 1% of the population. I've used that statistic forever. I think it still holds that for people who struggle with mental health, it's the severe mental health issues, about 1%, where they, you know, become violent or end up, you know, committing crime. And also for many people with severe mental health issues, they don't commit any crimes. They just have become so severely debilitated they cannot function. And in those cases, having the medications is life saving. But I think that we don't look at the vastness of the spectrum to see that it's a very, very tiny amount of people who are on that severe end. But really, the vast majority of people, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, are the worried well, those who are going through breakups or divorce or grief or loss. And those are also real experiences of pain and suffering, but they take an entirely different mental health care approach than what we would see in a Atascadero State Hospital. And I really wish we could find a way to separate out the different classes of mental health issues so that people could get a true understanding of how care can actually look like. So I appreciate you calling and reminding me to bring that piece up, that there are severe mental health issues that demand medications and higher levels of care.
I totally agree. Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that.
Yeah. Well, thank you for calling, Tom. I appreciate you tuning into the show.
Yes, and thank you so much. It's just your breath of fresh air to listen to your perspective. You really are.
I appreciate it. You made my day. Thank you. Have a good day. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. It's Mental Health Awareness Month. I'm talking about how I got here to this chair, and I'm going to talk about some good news about mental health care on the horizon. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue with the conversation and your calls right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Things will be brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Someday, yeah, we'll put it together and we'll get it all done. Someday, when your head is much lighter. Someday, yeah, we'll walk in the rays of a beautiful sun. Someday, when the world is much brighter.
I'm Elizabeth Baird, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. And what's your experience with your own mental health or seeking mental health care? I'm curious to know, you know, what is happening out in the world around me? Because I deal, you know, primarily with college students. I teach at the university. I have a great insight and understanding of what's happening to the 20-somethings of our society. I also work a lot with younger adolescents. I have a great love and understanding of what happens for our adolescents. Now, I wish that we could help parents feel less frightened by the changes that teenagers go through between the ages of 12 and 25. You know, adolescence by definition means little death. And it's the death of their childhood and the death of that innocence, that, you know, belief that everything is going to be okay. And so imagine how overwhelming it is to experience all kind of the end of the innocent eras of your life and stepping into things that feel a little more daunting, not a little more, but greatly daunting. Then I've also done work with midlife clients who have found themselves doing everything right and putting everything into order and getting a great college degree and getting married and having kids and looking around and thinking, oh my goodness, this isn't what I thought it would be like. And feeling this existential angst of what is the meaning of everything we're doing. And those are all periods of transition. They're normal periods of transition. And I talked last week about Eric Erickson's different developmental stages and the tasks and challenges that we go through. And so I wish that we would step back a little bit and normalize those expected transitions as we go through life and give young people the tools and give people in midlife the tools to address those existential feelings of meaninglessness and to normalize them. And then if people do feel like, oh, I need to talk to someone. I need help figuring out. I need skills to do better in my marriage. If we could look at needing help as more of skills training and not from a perspective of, oh, I'm sick and broken, and so it must be me and I need help. If we could switch that, it would make all the difference, I think, in the success people felt in their life and the care that they're getting. I'm trying to decide which direction to go because I want to tell a whole story about how the mental health field got themselves in this place where we felt that we needed to, you know, become part of the medical model and look at the disease model and, you know, step away from our understanding of the psyche and the human experience and the normal dissonance that we feel through every period of growth. But it might be too long of a story. But let's just say it has a lot to do with the false memory syndrome that came up in the 1990s when there was a whole wave of young women remembering abuse in their childhood that for many women were true, but for many, many other women, it was not true. And this caused hysteria in the country and a distrust of psychotherapists that were, you know, leading women into these remembrances that weren't actually true. And then also at the same time, we had the McMartin trial where the children were feared that they were being abused at the McMartin preschool. And as it turns out, it hadn't happened. It wasn't true. But the well-meaning psychotherapists and psychologists that rushed in to interview the children were implanting these memories. And so that blew up psychotherapy in the world of psychology instantaneously. And so from the late 90s into the 2000s, it was a rebuilding campaign to try to get, you know, more validity into the practice of mental health care. And then the idea of destigmatizing, yes, it was to try to normalize mental health and mental health care for populations, different cultures that were not trusting of talking about feelings or exposing family stories. But the part we don't talk about was that a lot of the rebranding was to try to cover up the glitches, the absolute failure of the 90s psychotherapies that led to a lot of harm to a lot of people. So that's kind of the history of how we got to where we are today. And this kind of conflict between this, you know, adherence to this medical model, it's got to be disease-based, and then this whole part of the profession that says, no, we have to look at the social, we have to look at the social environment, the external factors that impact people's lives. So let's say that there's something you want to work on, whether it's your marriage, better relationships with your children. Try to find a new career that you feel stalled out and you want to go in a different direction. You're trying to deal with the loss of a loved one. All of those things are normal passages in throughout the lifespan. And most times we're able to move through these with a cup of coffee with friends or some deep thought or, you know, just kind of working it out with our partners. But in many cases, we can't get through it and we need to have some help. And so where do we go to find that help? Well, most therapy, as I said, is the worried well or the ones people that are able to get up and go to work, but they're struggling with anxiety and depression. They're able to see friends, but it's really a task. They're able to exercise and mostly eat well, but they still have this underlining feeling of discomfort. That group is the vast majority of people who seek counseling. And so the counseling that they are really looking for is a combination of psychodynamic or psychoanalytic work, looking into our past, our history, our family story, so we get some understanding and insight of maybe how we view the world. And then we want some guidance counseling, good old-fashioned guidance counseling. What are some skills that I can use? What are some, you know, tips that would be helpful? What are some ways that I can expand my understanding and horizons of opportunities for myself? You know, and then you also might need a little bit of coaching along with that as well. Just like if you've got the desire, you know, I'll help you get there. That is kind of the flavor of counseling that the vast majority of people need. Now, if you're looking at the list of mental health providers, most people, and I brought this up before, if you're looking at, there is a hierarchy, and the hierarchy is pretty entrenched. And so at the top of the hierarchy would be, they would consider themselves the top of the hierarchy, it would be psychiatrists, and they go to med school, and they're the ones that write prescriptions, along with primary care physicians and also some psychiatric practitioners as well. But that is the top of the medical model of healthcare. Psychiatrists also own the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, so the American Psychiatric Association owns it. They're the ones that publish it. They're the ones for the vast majority to decide what disorders go in there. Interestingly, it should concern you that when they put together the task force to add different disorders into the DSM, the last one, especially the DSM-5, there were no representatives of the American Counseling Association on those task force. There were MFTs, there were psychologists, but no one from the counseling end of it. And as I just said, counseling is a really important part of maintaining our mental wellness. Guidance counseling is wonderful. So there's a psychiatrist. Then you have the psychologists. They're doctor level clinicians. They go to school for 5 to 7 years. They spend a lot of time working on assessments along with working with different modalities of talk therapy. They also do internships and spend 3,000 hours getting training overseen by a supervisor before they are allowed to open their own private practice. And there's the PhD counseling psychologists. They are also doctors. They mostly get their training through universities, more traditional universities. And PhDs, because psychologists have kind of taken a step into the talk therapy world in greater numbers, and PhDs have always been aligned with research. More often than not, someone with a doctorate level of talk therapy is going to be a psychologist and not a PhD. But PhDs can be licensed to see clients. And then you have the master's level of clinicians. You have the licensed clinical social workers, and the social workers are the meat and potatoes of mental health care because they're working with finding housing and getting access to education plans and helping people connect to employment, like the real fundamentals. They're dealing with the societal issues that impact people's mental health and the understanding that if someone is worried about how they're going to feed their kids, it's really hard to sit and have a deep Rorschach conversation about what they see in the ink spot. And so the social workers really have a handle on addressing all of the external factors that impact someone's mental health. But then they also have the training to do the talk therapy piece to help people sort out what they're struggling with. Social workers also can open their own private practices as well as working for the county or in hospitals or in different clinics. Then you have the LMFTs, which is my license. You have the AAMFTs, which is an association of mental marriage and family therapists. You have the licensed clinical counselors, licensed professional clinical counselors. You have the mental health clinical counselors. But they're all of us are master's level clinicians who also have been trained to do talk therapy, different modalities. When I talk about modalities, it's like different ways of using psychotherapy, whether it's ACT or CBT or EPP or DBT. There's so many acronyms. We'll talk about a few. We're trained to utilize all of those techniques, but we also really focused on the relational aspects of dealing with the human experience. So really specializing in marriage and family work, working with children, working with grief, working with transitions, working with change, and also have 3,000 hours of supervised training under a licensed professional before we can open our own private practice. And then, so those are the licensed clinicians that you can access. And then there's, you know, kind of this other side category of life coaches that a lot of people, you know, do certifications, and it's very much kind of the more directive style of helping someone. There's a lot of feelings about coaches. I'll just leave it at that. Because I would say that a lot of the work that I do is very much coaching oriented, but from a depth psychology training perspective. So I understand the benefits of having a coaching style therapist to work with. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. I'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on today's topic. And Donna, just briefly, to break up my story here. Were you aware of all of those different categories of clinicians?
Actually, no. The information that you're giving out today is a lot. A lot.
Is it too much, maybe?
No. Okay. Because it wasn't like you broke down all of the acronyms and stuff, but I think that you gave us a real sense of how expansive this profession is, this area of help is. And it's like, wow, I wouldn't even know where to begin. Actually, I do, because I would send you a text.
Yes. And you would have the inside scoop, which is why, again, we've done this show for 15 or 17 years. It's like, yes, I want people to have access to that information. So, yes, if you were struggling with, let's say, a relational issue, you know, and you said, I really want to do better. I want to have better communication. I want to get along better with, you know, my siblings, roommates, whoever it is. And I say, you know what? That's a great thing to get some skill training with. So let's start with the master's level people, because they're into that relational stuff. Like, let's look at your list of providers that are in the master's level. And then most clinicians have websites now, which is kind of wonderful. And so you can see a photo of them, and they usually list what their education is, and they talk about all of the different areas they specialize in. Because let's be honest, you know, there are so many ways that the human experience can go that no one can be an expert on every single experience. Like, one of the things that I'm not an expert in at all, and people have asked me to do a show, and I have yet to find the person. So if you are the person that knows this, send me an email. I don't know a lot about hoarding and the whole mental health aspect that goes into that. And so imagine all the ways that we can get into trouble. You're going to want to find a clinician that has some understanding and some training in that specifically. You know, and maybe it's pastoral counseling that you need, and maybe it is best to find a clinician who has a leaning towards a specific religious affiliation. So when it's relational of any kind, transitional, relational, internal, go to the MFTs and look at their websites and find someone who aligns. And then if it's an MFT worth their weight, not just MFT, but any of the lab master's levels, social workers, LPCCs, the master's levels, any of them who really is doing their job is going to offer you a consultation, 15 minutes. I do a full session when I'm seeing people so they can see how I work, so I can get to know them, because I don't want to take anyone on unless I know I can work with them and that they know that they can work for me. So then take those consults and don't sign on the dotted line to do work with someone until you feel like you have a connection. Because here's the real, another of the secrets. When they look at research about what makes talk therapy successful or psychotherapy successful, only 15% of it is the actual intervention, whether they use CBT or ACT, all the different acronyms. That's only 15% of the potential success. The vast majority of the rest of it is the clinician relationship to the client. That's almost 50 or 60%. And then the rest of it is the extra therapeutic factors, which is how willing is the client to do the work? Are they really ready to change? Are they really ready to talk about tough things? Are they really ready to adjust their behaviors or, you know, make significant changes in their life to get better or to feel better? And those are the things that we really want to pay attention to, that if you feel like you click with your clinician, and when they talk about the tools they use or the different skills, and you go, I think I would like to take that on. I'd like to try that eye movement desensitization and reprogramming, which is EMDR. That sounds really fascinating. I think that resonates with me. Find the person who uses the tools that resonate with you, and you have the highest likelihood of success. And then if you have greater struggles, right? Now, if you're above the mid to lower level concerns, which is most people, as I said, you can still get to work. You can still, you know, go out with your friends. You just aren't feeling it. It's kind of hard. You feel like you're suffering and struggling to do that. That's that giant group. If you're at the part where you're not getting out of bed and you're not showering and you're not going to work, then that's that next level. We call the mid to higher level range of mental health issues. And you could still see a master's level clinician, but you might want to up it a bit. And, you know, there's psychologists that have training in different assessments that might help you really get an understanding of what the issues are for you, maybe going to the deeper dive, maybe work with a clinician that specializes in psychodynamic or people known as the Freudian work to get into that real deep orders of change. And also, it helps to get that medical evaluation if you're not getting out of bed and not showering and not eating to see if there is something going on biologically, or you might be in that category of the, you know, 1 to 5% who need that medication in order to get the jump start so that you can start towards more healing to getting back to your life. So those are the steps. If you contact me and say, here's where we're going to go, where do you fall on this scale so we can help direct you to that correct person? This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and our number is 805-781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. In our last few minutes, if you have a question about mental health care or concerns or where to look, now's the time to call. But let me break down a few of the types of psychotherapy right now that I see doing good things. EMDR is one of my favorites. We talked to Dr. Deborah Korn twice. She's from Johns Hopkins University. EMDR has been around for almost 30 years. It has a very high success rate of working with PTSD and suicidal ideation and depression and anxiety. Highly recommended looking into those. There's skilled clinicians that you can find through the EMDR national website or just looking for local clinicians that practice EMDR. And that's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It helps get to kind of the heart of a trauma or an incident or an experience and help it be removed out of the forefront of your mind, causing these symptoms and reactions over and over again, much like what PTSD does. So that's EMDR. There's also ACT, that's acceptance commitment therapy. And this is actually the type of therapy that a lot of psychiatrists that are trying to move away from the medical model and are trying to do more talk therapy, a lot of them are using ACT. And they combine a lot of mindfulness strategies, then also behavior changes to help increase the individual's psychological flexibility. Basically, you know, a lot of people, when they feel depressed, like it's raining, and say, it's raining, it's awful, why is it always raining? I feel so terrible, nothing goes my way. And they get caught in that ruminating loop of things being catastrophic. And in ACT, the first step is, if it's raining, you need to just say, it's raining. And then we start building from there. And it's about accepting what is and then taking actions as best you can to move forward. Looks like we have a call, so I'm going to jump to the line right now. And I think it's Christian. Are you there?
Good to talk with you.
Hi.
I was just going to comment. I think our problem, what you said, like the big redeeming factor of a therapist is this connection.
Yes.
One human being talking to another.
Yes.
I mean, I came out of another human being. It's a little hard for me just to disconnect and be connected to my Amazon account and not to other humans.
Yes.
I think we lost it when we stopped taking each other to the airport.
Yeah,
I mean, that sounds trite and like a simple solution, but when it became where like you couldn't ask your neighbor, hey, can you take me to the airport? I need a lift. Mm-hmm. Where it's like Uber and Lyft, which is, you know, that's all well and good. But that's the thing about it, is that connection. And I was startled by some of the information you gave today. It was great about who writes up this DSM, mm-hmm. which is probably a psychiatrist who has a drinking problem, because I think now alcoholism is no longer alcoholism. I think it's alcohol use disorder.
Yes, it
and
is.
How these people have this power that we don't even realize. How do these things come to in fruition? And this is how, which you just explained to us, which I go. Now I see. That's a little bit more clear to me. But anyway, great points, and appreciate you, and thanks for letting me come on and shoot my Irish mouth out for a minute.
I appreciate you, Christian. I appreciate you calling. Also, you know, that part of connection is absolutely cannot be overstated, that when we have part of the work of counseling is to help people start making social connections again. That's part of the work, is getting people into the community, into society. And once they're connected, they don't need that therapist anymore. So you're right on. Thank you for calling. I appreciate you.
Are you still there?
Well, I did jump to the next one, but one last point real quick.
Dementia. I always thought that would be more from heredity or from drinking and drugging, right?
Mm-mm.
It's social isolation.
Well, and you also, yeah, and there's a show I did last year, about dementia and the changes. And if you send me an email, Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, I'll send you a link to that show. It is fascinating. Thanks for calling, Christian.
Wonderful.
All right, Stephen, you get the last word here. What's on your mind today?
Yes, I was curious, how often do you find malingering to be an issue with this new world mental health disorder situation?
I realize that they
Discounted it after the DSM-3, mm-hmm. as they determined it not to be a true mental disorder. But how often do you encounter this in your practice of folks basically just going, oh, I'm through with this world, I want out, I have this mental disorder?
I think that's such a longer topic. I wish I had another half hour. But part of it even was the switch to this idea of the existential angst of the meaningless of life. You know, so instead of making it a mental disorder, it was more of this acceptance of, oh, actually, universally, almost all human beings at some point in their life face that existential truth that life is virtually meaningless unless we give it meaning ourselves. And so,
right.
And so that's when we start to recognize that feeling like the world has no meaning and we're isolated and alienated is actually a normal response to the human condition. And so wouldn't we much be better served to recognize that and help people then find meaning in their life? One of the best books ever was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. So I hope those two things help. And I hope you'll call again, because this is the longer conversation we need to have.
Viktor Frankl. Okay.
Viktor Frankl. F R A N K L.
Sometimes people do just give up.
Yes.
And I've been through multiple issues and I haven't given up, but someone I know has kind of given up.
Well, find Victor's book, V-I-K.
Disheartening.
It is disheartening, but there is hope. And this book is a great place to start, because it's a heavy first half of the read, because he was in a concentration camp. But the second half is all about logotherapy and how he discovered the meaning and purpose of his life and gave foundation to himself and all of his clients. So it's Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. Wow. We got so busy at the end there, Don. I wish we could take all the calls, but I hope that this starts a conversation we can continue next week. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. You can find me on Facebook, on Instagram. Send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. As always, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for supporting this show and also Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Darling, this world ain't for the faint of heart. Nah. Feel like we were made to fall apart. I could build your heart an army. Yeah. Don't gotta do this all by yourself. If you need someone, you call me. Yeah. You got me. Yeah. You got me. Oh, I could be a lifeline. Stay with you till the sunrise. When you're low, you don't mean you're alone. I'll be by your side. Oh, I could be the reason. Feel your demons. When you're alone, they don't mean you're alone. I'll be by your side. Oh, I could be a lifeline. Oh, I could be a lifeline.
to glow, and I'll fade. Reach your hand out in the dark, and I'll meet you halfway. Cause your heart's an army.
Yes, it is.
You gotta do this all by yourself. If you need someone, you call me.
All you gotta
do. Look to your left, look to your right, I'll be right here. I'll be by your side. Look to your left, look to your right, I'll be right here. I'll be by your side. Look to your left, look to your right, I'll be right here. I'll be by your side.